This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Ratchford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and UConn Health Orthopedic and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You are encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC, News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information, and we answer all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be back with you live for this program. As many of our regular listeners will note, I've been away for the past several weeks on vacation. And it was an interesting vacation from the standpoint that we did something different. My wife and I took a voyage. I guess that would be a better word than cruise. We took a transatlantic voyage to Europe, and it was phenomenal in the sense of we were on the Queen Mary II, which is a ship built specifically for transatlantic voyages. Its hull is different, so that it is much more stable. It was extremely comfortable, and it's really a great opportunity to relax and really rewind things from that standpoint. It's also an opportunity to meet a lot of people over an extended period of time. It takes about 7 days to cross the Atlantic by ship. And the Cunard line, which we were on, certainly provides so much from the standpoint of shows and culture and lectures. We had so many wonderful lecturers. One of the lecturers was Nelson Mandela's bodyguard. We had famous athletes who were there. We had radio broadcasters and TV broadcasters, many from other countries. So it was very interesting. What was also interesting was when you cross by ship, you don't get the jet lag, right? So you're still changing your clock, but it's so gradual. But one of the things I enjoyed the most, really, as I mentioned, was chatting with other people, people from other countries, especially with regard to health care. And I'll be referring to some of these conversations really intermittently throughout the show, not just today. But most of the other countries, matter of fact, all the other countries that we were in, had socialized medicine. And obviously, like any other system, there are a lot of pros and cons. Now, one of the things I've advocated for is that we need to change the system here. We spend more than any other country in the world on healthcare. And yet, our longevity is going down. So what's interesting is that we're putting more money into the system, and yet we're dying younger. And that just defines a bad system. And some of the things that I spoke to people about are, you know, that their big problem in England is they have longer waits to get specialized care. But they have ready access to primary care, which is where the prevention starts, which is where you start getting out in front of patients of your illnesses. So they have kind of an opposite system than we have here, because it is difficult getting into a primary care physician. Certainly is here in Connecticut, where a lot of people have to go to various walk-in clinics to get some care rather than their regular physician. So in many of these foreign countries, what they do is they emphasize primary care, and then they wait for specialized care. Obviously not if it's urgent or emergent. So it's a different type of investment in health. But they're struggling. What they have are government-employed physicians, and for the National Health Service there in England, and they're on strike. Their physicians want to be paid more for the time they put in working for the government. Again, they don't have high rates of tuition, So that's why they spend time working for a relatively lower wage. Here's one thing I noticed, and my wife noticed as well, is that many people from foreign countries are wearing hearing aids, especially the English. So many men, especially, I guess you could see it more in men, are wearing hearing aids and some amplification device. And it's interesting because we've talked about it on this program. The use of hearing aids is a modifiable risk factor for dementia. And it's believed that 40% of people in the United States over the age of 65 need hearing aids and do not have them. Why? Because they're so expensive. Whereas in other countries, such as in England, the National Health Service pays for the hearing aids. And obviously, the thought there is that on the back end, you can avoid, first of all, make somebody's life more comfortable, maybe keep them working longer, but more importantly, avoid the cost of a more chronic condition such as dementia. Now, we're moving toward that here in the sense of, not that it's free, but the cost is coming down now that you don't have to have it only made by prescription. But these generally cost, you know, the costs are of average about $4,000 for the better of the type of hearing aid. So we're going to be talking a little bit more about socialized medicine and the things I learned while away. Today's lineup, I want to talk about the increasing rates of cancer in young people. Specifically, cancer rates are climbing in people under the age of 50. And, you know, 60% of cancers are those in over the age of 65, but we're seeing this climbing rate in young people, and specifically with respect to colon cancer. So my guest today is going to be Dr. Jaykumar Thumar, who's a hematologist-oncologist from Hartford Healthcare. So he's going to be joining us sometime in the second half of the program today. And we're going to talk about this change in cancer and what can we do? Do we need to do better screening? Is what we're doing adequate? And are there, again, modifiable risk factors for cancer among young people? And we're going to be talking a little bit about vaccinations and the increase in COVID. This day in medicine, August 26, 1842. Dr. Heinrich Quincke was born. Now, Dr. Quincke was a German physician who discovered the lumbar puncture, also notoriously known as the spinal tap. But the lumbar puncture, a procedure we still perform today, is so crucial because what we're trying to do is insert a small needle in the lower back to obtain cerebrospinal fluid. That's the fluid that surrounds the brain and spinal cord. And that is where you find out if someone has an infection or inflammation or cancer affecting the central nervous system. So it is the most direct way we can do that without doing an actual biopsy. The lumbar puncture is also key when we're measuring pressure, right? When we think of the brain is in a closed space, as is the spinal cord. So when pressure builds up, there's nowhere for it to go. So you have to be very mindful of that pressure and monitoring it, especially in someone who has a brain injury, whether it be blood or swelling, so that you can manage it. And again, it's through putting in a tap of some type, through a lumbar puncture, to measure that pressure. It's gotten a bad reputation, let's face it. When people hear the word spinal tap, you think of this 6-inch needle that is bludgeoned into someone's spine, but that's certainly not the case anymore. The instrument used, the needle used, is actually very small. And the reason a smaller needle is used is because most of the time this procedure is done under fluoroscopy. So with x-ray guidance, you could be much more exact as to where the needle is being placed to obtain the fluid, and so that you could measure someone's pressure. So it's much less uncomfortable. The real discomfort comes in is if you have a persistent leak. So like anything else, when you pierce the membrane to take the fluid out, you make a hole. That hole will heal relatively quickly, but if you put it under pressure, for example, coughing or running or exerting yourself, spinal fluid will leak from that hole and result in a severe headache. It's a very typical type of headache. The headache only comes on when you're sitting or standing. As soon as the person lays down and gets pressure off where that hole is, the headache immediately clears. So again, that's why we stress to people cutting back their activity after having a lumbar puncture. So we remember Dr. Quincke and his work back from the mid-1800s. With that, we're going to take a short break. They're going to be back to talk about COVID. We're going to talk about guns and the death rate and the cause of death in young people being related to guns. And then in the second half of the program, we're going to be talking to Dr. Thumar from Hartford Hospital regarding increasing cancer rates in young people. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. And if you have questions, as always, either live while I'm on the air or during the week, you can reach me at info@alessimd.com. One of the things that has come up once again is the fact that the greatest cause of death, the number one cause of death in children and adolescents, again in 2021, is gun violence. Hard to believe. But this is the second year that that's been the case. Prior to that, it was motor vehicle accidents. So 2020 really was the first year that gun-related incidents exceeded the death of children, the ages of newborn to age 19. In 2021, the number's like 4,752 deaths. That was an increase of 42% from 2018. Right? So in just 3 years, a 42% rise in gun-related deaths. And this was all looked at in the Journal of the American Academy of Pediatrics recently. Two-thirds of these deaths are homicides. Another 30% were suicide, and 3.5% were from unintentional use of weapons. So we're really seeing the fact that guns are playing a big role in affecting the health of our young people. When it comes to homicide, when we looked at it socioeconomically, first of all, most of these deaths increase as you go down in socioeconomic status from income. And when we look at homicides, they are primarily in blacks and other people of color, as opposed to suicide, which is higher among those who are white. And what it breaks down to is that why do we have so many guns in this country? Why are they so readily available? And why are children having access to these? So getting back to my recent trip, I met with a fellow and chatting, and he's a gunsmith from England. I don't know much about guns, and here's a gunsmith, and obviously he's pro-gun from the standpoint of his business. But what's very interesting is that in England and in other European countries, it takes a lot to get a gun. I mean, not just background tests, background checks. It's not just, looking at your whole past, but also demonstrating that you effectively know how to use a weapon. In England, police still don't carry weapons. I met another person whose son was a detective sergeant in London, and he doesn't carry a gun. I mean, we see everybody carrying huge weapons. Now, they're trained in how to use guns, and there are police who are armed, but by and large, the police force in England is not walking around with a gun. And it's interesting because we see so many of the recent deaths are, you know, mistaken identity or any number of things. So it really speaks to us as a society that things are changing and that guns are becoming more available. And what are we going to do about it? Well, you can restrict guns, but there was just a study performed, and the study was published in the JAMA Pediatrics, in which what they did was they used a one-minute video to show young children between the ages of 8 and 12 gun safety. And really try to diminish this use of guns and to demonstrate gun safety and the importance if they are around guns. And basically, in this study, and it was a small study done, but in the study, they were able to demonstrate that when they took two groups, those that were shown this particular video and those who were not, the ones who were shown the video did have more understanding of guns and the importance of gun safety. So I think this is a problem that we need to address from multiple standpoints. I've been receiving emails and questions from folks regarding vaccines, COVID, the new rise in COVID that we're seeing. So I am going to have one of our established experts on to discuss these, but I think it deserves some attention now. And first of all, COVID is here to stay, folks. We've said that. It's going to be like the flu. Every year, it's going to rise as it is now. And hopefully not be as virulent from the standpoint of causing harm. But right now, there are three different variants, the EG5, FL151, and the BA286. So these are the new variants that we've identified. The 286 is the most transmissible, but less dangerous than the Omicron that we dealt with before. With respect to vaccines, and having had COVID in the past, these various mutations have changed to a large degree in that you do not necessarily have protection. That's why you have to keep up with vaccines. A new vaccine will be available in mid-September, and there's every indication that these will be from Pfizer, Moderna, Novavax, and there's every indication that these will be able to protect us as we go into the fall and winter. So people are asking me, should we be getting vaccines now? I would wait till mid-September, and that's been the recommendation I've been getting, and we're going to get an expert on, obviously, to talk about it.
This has been Healthy Rounds
and
with Dr.
We're going to take a short break now, and then we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Jay Kumar Thumar. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you for the second half of our program. My guest today who's joined us is Dr. Jay Kumar Thumar. Dr. Thumar is an internist. He's a medical doctor, an internist, and specializing in hematology oncology. And I really wanted to get him on today because I'm alarmed somewhat over the fact that we're seeing increasing rates of cancer in people under the age of 50. So many of the things we do to screen for cancer are in older people, right? And that's what we talk to the physician, you know, the U.S. Services Task Force. But why are we seeing these other rates? So I thought it was great to have him on. Jay, welcome to the show.
Hey, good morning. Very nice to be here.
Hey, Jay, let's talk a little bit. So tell us about your training. What, you know, about a hematologist? How did you get to be a hematologist oncologist?
All right. Yes, I'm a medical oncologist hematologist. So our training involves training in general internal medicine, which is our sort of our base of training, and then we go to fellowship where we get an extra training for additional 3-5 years to train to become a specialist. So I'm a trained hematologist oncologist. I treat cancer patients, and now in last decade or even more than that, we are. All of us also specialize. So my subspecialty is to treat patients with GI or gastrointestinal malignancies such as colon cancer, liver cancer, pancreatic cancer, rectal cancer. So I am an oncologist who focus my practice on GI cancers.
And that's why I wanted to have you on, because that's among the cancers where we're seeing this increase. It's colon and thyroid were the two biggest ones where we're starting to see, as well as breast cancer in people under the age of 50. Why are we seeing these increasing rates, Jay? What do you think?
Well, I mean, I think we have an idea what's causing it. But I think let's look at the number first. So if you look at the last decade, American Cancer Society publishes this data every year. And what we have seen is there's a striking rise in colon cancer in last 10 years. In last decade, it's almost 8%, 10% rise. And what's very striking is that it's young people. The number has nearly doubled in last 10 years for people who are under 55 with the diagnosis of colon cancer. We are seeing a double number, so 20% incidence of young people with colon cancer, 1 in 5 individual. It's a huge number and a huge rise, and we are just seeing one decade. I'm hoping it's not a tip of an iceberg, but I think we are very, very, very surprised by this. And what answering your question now is that we think it's. I think there are a lot of things unknown here, but what we can see is clearly environmental factor, dietary factor. What's causing patients to develop colon cancer. Now, young patients tend to get colon cancer. 20 years ago, majority of those young people who were diagnosed with colon cancer had what we call Lynch syndrome, or patients who had some hereditary genetic risk factor to develop colon cancer. What we are seeing now is different. What we are seeing now is patients who have no family history whatsoever. So we think it's a lifestyle, obesity, secondary lifestyle factors, Western diet, high sugar intake, high intake of red meat. We think all of that are contributing. But I think the answer is still unknown. I think we don't know what's causing it, but we think it's a lifestyle.
Well, let me back up a little bit, actually, in the sense of, what qualifies as colon cancer. For example, one of the cancers I saw in the list was cancer of the appendix, and seeing a rise in that. Does that factor into colon cancer? And does it include rectal cancer?
Correct. So rectal cancer is part of the colon cancer. We group them as a colorectal cancer. Now, appendix cancer is actually a little bit different because they behave a little bit differently. However, they are still an intestinal tract. Appendix is close to the large bowel or cecum or a part of the colon cancer. So I think it's a continuum. So medically, I think it all makes sense. If you are seeing a rise in colon cancer, you will see a rise in colon cancer, appendix cancer, and rectal cancer because they're all continuous part of your intestine. And they all have the same exposure. Whatever environmental factor that's exposing and causing these cancers will have, effect on entire GI tract, essentially.
Okay. Now, you talked about some of the causes, obesity being one of them. Dietary, red meat, increased sugars, smoking, is that a factor?
The link between smoking and colon cancer is not as strong as link between smoking and head and neck cancer or throat cancer or lung cancer. But we believe that smoking is not healthy, and smoking clearly has has increased the risk of any kind of cancer, I think. But there's no direct link, as far as I can tell, based on what we see. Answering your question, we don't see a link between smoking and colon cancer. However, we strongly feel that smoking does contribute to developing any kind of cancer.
How about people with inflammatory bowel disease? So people who have Crohn's or diverticulitis or any of the autoimmune bowel diseases, are they more likely to develop colon cancer?
That is correct. So patients who have underlying inflammatory bowel disease, particularly ulcerative colitis, have high risk of developing colon cancer compared to patients who don't have, people who don't have it. And you know, there are guidelines now that a majority of these patients who are being followed by a gastroenterologist, they are being watched as they go, particularly after 10 years or after you having severe involvement of the intestine, there's a risk of developing colon cancer. And then those people are being closely watched by their gastroenterologist, and they will go through annual colonoscopy to make sure that they're not developing any signs of that, something called dysplasia or early form of colon cancer that they develop.
Okay, so how about familial problems? So in other words, if it runs in your family, are there genetics behind developing colon cancer in young people?
Yes, absolutely right. So colon cancer is, you know, there is a condition called Lynch syndrome, which is a familial hereditary condition where patients can develop colon cancer at early age, and you will see multiple family members developing colon cancer. Those patients, you know, once we know that a particular patient has Lynch syndrome, they will get more frequent follow-up with their gastroenterologist and will have more cancer screening. So Lynch syndrome is actually one of the conditions where people can get colon cancer, correct.
How common is that? I mean, I have to be honest with you, I've never heard of it. How common is that? And do we know the genotype that we're looking for in people who may develop Lynch syndrome?
Yes. So Lynch syndrome is relatively uncommon. I would say if I have 100 patients with colon cancer, the chance of somebody having Lynch syndrome is close to about 5 to 7%. You know, so it's one of the uncommon cause of colon cancer as such. So majority of patients who are developing colon cancers don't have Lynch. That being said, you know, we have a very clear idea about what mutation that leads to colon cancer and Lynch syndrome. And there are guidelines to follow patients who have diagnosis of Lynch syndrome. So technically, anybody who has colon cancer and anybody who has a history of colon cancer in their family member, there's a higher risk of them having a Lynch syndrome. So we look at every individual who goes to their primary doctor for routine checkup. You know, we recommend patients to talk about their family history and have the primary doctor figure out if patient has a high risk of you know, hereditary cancer syndrome like Lynch syndrome.
One of the controversies among physicians and others has been, well, we're seeing more of these things because we have increased tests, we're looking more, and that's why we're seeing an increase in these cancers. And where the controversy comes in is people are saying, well, when we do some of these screenings or someone has an MRI for something else, suddenly we're coming up with something that may not be a cancer. Do you think that's the reason? I mean, we've talked about the environmental factors, and I don't think we could deny that. But do you think that the increased numbers are because we're looking more or because the technology has gotten so far ahead?
So that's a very interesting, statement. I think what – so let's look at, you know, if we look at our national data about how many patients who are above age of 50 – getting colon cancer screening, we are barely touching, you know, 50-60%. So there's a substantial number of patients who are appropriate for cancer screening.
It's
for colon
cancer. It's that low?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Only 50 or 60%.
Yeah. We I think right now the age group between 50 and 54 is only barely 50%.
Wow.
Yeah. So we are not doing a great job screening everybody for cancer prevention. Absolutely right. And you know, there's also the access to care. A lot of patients who either don't have insurance, people who are immigrant, people who are, you know, low socioeconomical class, all that are factoring in. So I think, yes, we are getting better in terms of what we are doing in terms of screening. However, we are still not, you know, capturing all the patients who are at risk. And if you look at, and United States Preventive Service Task Force has now endorsed colon cancer screening starting at age of 45. So they wanted us to screen patients who are less than 50 now. And I'm talking about people who are
finally
50 to 54. Right.
Yeah.
So even the older recommendation of anybody after age of 50, if you look at the number between 50 and 54, that group of patients who should be screened, we are only reaching 50%. So, yes, we have a substantial lag in terms of who are we screening, and general cancer screening is definitely lacking.
Mm-hmm. So let's get into the dreaded screening. Right? Nobody wants to have a colonoscopy, it seems. But now we have Cologuard, right? People are talking mm-hmm. about, well, you could use Cologuard. Can you talk to us a little bit about what is effect? And for a while they were doing like CT scans of the colon and things such as that. So can you kind of sum up for us how should we be screening? What's the right way to go about this?
So there are, you know, there are many ways, fortunately, to screen patients for colon cancer. There are many tools. So colonoscopy is not just the only tool that we have good data to support that there are other additional tests that we can apply. Now, before we talk about cancer screening, I think the discussion that patient has to have with the primary doctor or a gastroenterologist is that what is their risk? Are you a general risk or are you at higher risk based on your family history? And based on that, you know, the doctor will decide what is the best or what is the most appropriate tool to screen. So right now, there are three big categories. One is the stool testing, where you just provide a stool sample. We can do testing on that. That's the Cologuard. Other testing is colonoscopy or endoscopy screening, which involves you to have a bowel preparation. So you have to have, you know, at least a 24-hour preparation to make sure you have your clean bowel before the doctors can check and put a camera. And the third test is CAT scan. So there are essentially three different categories of testing that people can utilize. Now, if somebody has a high risk of anesthesia or they don't want to pursue colonoscopy, I think clearly they have alternative options for them. So if somebody is afraid of colonoscopy, talk to your doctor and have a discussion with them, and they will offer you treatment that fits your preference and that fits your risk category.
So colonoscopy is the best test. I mean, if you were going to do one specific test,
absolutely,
a colonoscopy after an adequate prep where you really clean out the bowel, you would say that is the best test we could be doing to screen.
Absolutely right. So, I think colonoscopy still remains the most preferred test because let's say you got a Cologuard test and your test came back positive. That tells you that there is something going on. Either you have a precancerous polyp or you have a colon cancer, and then that will require you to go and do colonoscopy eventually because the Cologuard test is only going to tell you whether you are positive or negative. If you are negative, that's good. It's a very good test to exclude colon cancer. But if test turns out to be positive, then you will require colonoscopy or additional testing to confirm the diagnosis and get the treatment. So if you want to have one option, colonoscopy is the best option.
You know, my limited experience is that anybody I've spoken to who's done the Cologuard has eventually had to have the colonoscopy anyhow. So,
correct.
Because it is a very sensitive test.
Right. And also, colon cancer is very common. You know,
yeah.
So that's why I think if you were to really do a test where you can kill two birds in one stone, that will be colonoscopy. Remember, another thing that we don't realize or people don't realize about colonoscopy is not only you are going in there to diagnose a cancer. So let's just say somebody goes for colonoscopy, they found a colon cancer, you were right at the 50 years mark, you found a cancer very early, you got the cancer out, and you are cured. So the one purpose of colonoscopy is early diagnosis. So we can diagnose cancer early, we can treat, and we can cure cancer early. That's one purpose. The second purpose is when we go for colonoscopy, we find polyps. They are not cancer, they are precancerous. And the doctors will take those polyp out. So not only you are early diagnosing, but you're also removing these polyps who can turn into cancer in the future. So colonoscopy serves two purposes. One, early diagnosis. Second, it prevents colon cancer by taking those polyps out and letting them turn into cancer. So that is why I think, you know, colonoscopy seems to be the best option according to me and according to data and the physicians who treat colon cancer.
Jay, is the prep getting any easier? Because the prep is worse than the procedure. I mean, everybody tells you that.
Right. I know. Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, definitely the preps are easier. They're one-day preparation and all that. But prep is a prep, and it has its own issues. And unfortunately, you know, we haven't figured out a perfect way to do a prep where patient can have no issues. You know, I turned 45. I had my colonoscopy, and I can tell you prep is difficult. But hey, we are trying to diagnose early colon cancer, and I think it's worth it.
Yeah, no, you're right.
Yeah.
I had a question. I didn't want to interrupt you, but before we take a break, I want to know, when people go for their regular routine visits with their primary care doctor, how effective is doing a GWIAC?
So that's a very, very important question. I think if you can compare various tests for sensitivity and specificity. And I don't have a numbers in front of me right now, but you know, stool GWAC is not as sensitive. It requires frequent testing also. So you have to understand it's just not one shot. You know, fecal testing for occult blood requires to be done annually on a single sample, and it is an option.
But it should be part of the basic exam.
Correct.
I want people to know that. So when they go to their primary, because when they go to have their primary care evaluation, that annually you should have a stool GWIAC and a digital exam.
Yeah. Yeah. So we advise screening by fecal testing or stool occult blood testing has to be done annually, and particularly for patients who are unable or unwilling to go for a colonoscopy as an initial screening. But remember that. There has to be an understanding between doctor and patient that if this stool test results turn out to be positive, colonoscopy is needed to be done promptly. So this again, it's like a Cologuard test. It's an easy test, but it may require colonoscopy to be done. So that is something that people will have to have a clear understanding with their doctors.
Yeah. Jay, in closing, what's the one message you want to get across to anybody listening today?
Healthy lifestyle, exercise, look at your diet and see a doctor. Even though you are a healthy young individual, you have to have a primary doctor who can check you out for routine exam and talk about cancer screening and healthy lifestyle.
Jay, thank you. Thank you for your time today. I know you're especially busy. You're on call. Thanks for sharing your knowledge with us all. We really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you for having me. It was great to talk to you.
All right. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back to wrap things up. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds, and it's been great to be back with you for a live program. We're going to be live again next week. I want to thank my guest, Dr. Jay Kumar Thumar. Many thanks to Joey Borgoyne, who's been on the board for us today. I did get some questions, Tom and Paul, both of those questions regarding RSV and vaccination. We're going to address, hopefully I'm going to get somebody on next week and one of our infectious disease specialists to really address those issues as best we can as we get into the fall. If you have questions during the week, just reach me at info@alessimd.com. If you missed any part of today's program, you can get the Healthy Rounds podcast. Just download it at odyssey.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Up next on WTIC is going to be attorney John Matulis with Law Talk. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Rochford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.